Do we know what impatient means?
Yeah.
Well, we know what that means.
What does that mean?
Not patient.
Not patient. What does patient mean?
On a window seat in a prairie village den, a grandpa, his daughter, and two granddaughters read and chat together.
Yes, Ellie's the only person in this family, huh? What about Jackie?
These three generations weren't just spending time together, they lived together, an arrangement that may not be exactly mainstream around here, but these days it's becoming a lot more common. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll explore why families are increasingly choosing to cluster together and what that experience is like in Kansas City, from challenges such as finding the right kind of housing for everyone to the possible benefits for both children and the elderly. Lindsay Baker is here to give us a sense of exactly how things are changing in terms of attitudes toward multi-generational living. She's a gerontologist from UMKC's Consortium on Aging and Community. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. What's the history of multi-generational living in the United States?
Well, back in colonial times, and really any time pre-1940 or so, multi-generational living was more common in the United States than it is today. But that being said, it still wasn't at that time the predominant form of household structure. So, you know, it makes sense when you think about it. Back then, people had a lot of children, so they couldn't live with all of them. So, you know, if you have 5, 6, 7 children, you might live with one of them, but the rest of those children, unless they happen to be living with in-laws, are going to be living in more of a nuclear family structure. So even though it was more common, it wasn't always the predominant household structure in the United States. In 1940, you really started to see a decrease in people living in multi-generational households in the United States. And that was primarily due to the prosperity that we saw after the war. So as people gained financial independence, both young families and older adults, because of Social Security and entitlement programs such as that, as people were able to move out on their own, they did.
It's interesting that, you know, when people gained more financial prosperity, this is part of what they did with it, deciding to sort of separate into smaller groups living together, smaller households, mm-hmm. all in one home. Mm-hmm. Was there some sort of value attached to that, like an idea about what that meant?
Yes. And I think that especially in the United States, you really have a strong value placed on independence. And so for older adults, that meant, you know, for many, many years in our history, older adults not having the resources to be able to live on their own, or at least many of them couldn't, to be able to live on your own and be independent from your children was a very strongly held value. Same for children. Being able to move out of the house and work immediately after you left high school or college was something that people really valued. And so I think, you know, that what happened is in prior to 1940 or so, people often think of it that people maybe valued elders more or valued the idea of multi-generational living because they had such respect for their family members. But I think the change that happened was not so much due to a change in our values. It was just that financial opportunity. Before 1940, people just didn't have as many options as they did after 1940 or so.
Do we differ dramatically from other cultures worldwide in our attitude toward the practice of either staying with mom and dad into adulthood or shacking up with them again at some point down the road?
Yes, absolutely. And there's many, many examples from many, many countries. The most predominant culture that I would say that is very, very different than our own is in Asian culture, particularly in Chinese culture. There's a Confucian value that's referred to as filial piety. And it's a really complex idea, but the basic idea of filial piety is that there is ultimate respect for your elders and for your parents. The parent is the head of the household until the end of their life, no matter what. And deference is given to that parent in all household decisions. Okay, so there's this kind of long tradition of people in China and in other parts of Asia living in these multi-generational households. And there is an expectation that when your parents need something, that you will care for them. And you know, that to some extent exists in the United States, but clearly it's not as strong. We have more of a medicalized model of care at the end of life. And so you don't see people living in these types of multi-generational households as much. Although since 1970, we do see a slight increase in the number of people who are choosing to live in this type of multi-generational household.
Since 1970, you said?
Yes.
What do you think explains that? I mean, I've seen some documentation of trends toward an increase in that behavior very recently, like since the banking crisis of 2008, 2009. But yeah, back to 1970. What's going on there?
So the increase started in between 1970 and 1980, and it's grown very slowly over time. And there's really three different demographic trends that have contributed to it. The first, beginning in the 1970s and 80s, was the increase in divorce. So as people were divorced, often you would have a single mother with two children who either had to go to work after becoming divorced or had to move out of her home after becoming divorced. And at that point, those people started moving in with parents.
Because there was a mutual benefit.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The parents wanted to help out the child, and the child needed financial help. And often those homes weren't permanent. They were temporary situations for maybe a year or two until people got on their feet. But you did see this initial rise in the number of people, particularly among single parents, moving in with their parents. So that was the initial kind of rise in multi-generational households in the U.S.
Within the United States, and even maybe within Kansas City, do attitudes and practices regarding multi-generational living, do they vary a lot from one community or demographic to another?
Yes. And that kind of relates to those different demographic trends that I'm talking about here. So there are very specific racial and ethnic differences in the composition of these types of households. So what I talked about in terms of the rise in these kind of single parent households, that's really what you see most frequently in white non-Hispanic households. But moving to, for example, the most common racial and ethnic group, which would be African-American households, those households look a little bit different. And the reasons behind those formation of those households is very different. There are a large number of those households that are formed because both households are living in poverty and they can't pay their utilities and pay their housing bills on their own. So there's a long tradition in African-American families of multi-generational households as a way to pool resources and have enough money to get by. The other piece of that is in the early 1990s, you saw a really large increase in that population of skip-generation households where the parent was not present at all. And that was due largely to crack cocaine epidemic, mothers who became addicts and either their children were taken away from them because of neglect, or they ended up being incarcerated.
We're hearing, I mean, a lot about different cultures in the United States having done this out of necessity of some kind, out of circumstances that were really unfavorable, whether it's financial circumstances or, like an addiction problem, a divorce that's just happened. Are there other cultural underpinnings that actually value multi-generational living? I mean, here in the United States?
Yes. And I would say that you do see that, particularly when you look at three-generation households in the Asian population. What you see with that group is a choice to live together, not because the family is in poverty, not because there was a great need, but because they're following those values of filial piety. So you see that definitely in that culture. And what you see for multi-generational households there, when you look at the composition, it's two grandparents, two parents, and the grandchildren. So it's the whole family living together. So you see that often in that culture. But I think that you do see, you know, the last kind of trend that's contributed to this is since the recession. You see people forming these multi-generational households after the recession. And you see not only young children or children in their early 20s moving back in with their parents. But you also see a lot of two-parent households taking in grandparents. Now, we don't really know a lot about that at that point, whether that's because the grandparent needs help, whether that's because the family needs help. We haven't done enough research to find that out. But I think what you see, because of all these trends and the increasing commonality of it, what you see is as it becomes more common, people start to view it differently. And it has less of a stigma attached to it when you know people who do it.
Are there measurable benefits of multi-generational living?
I would say yes. Some of the research I've done in the past actually looks at the health of grandparents in these types of households. And one of the things we found is that during the transition into this, it can often be stressful for grandparents and it can be a detriment to their health. But in the long term, when those grandparents live with their grandchildren for a long time, they're very active. It keeps them healthy because they want to stay healthy in order to care for their grandchildren. It keeps them moving. It keeps them motivated. Another benefit is, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of pooling of resources in these households. And when you pool those resources, often the children see better financial stability than they would have had they been living, whether it was in the foster care system, whether it was living with a single mother. When you bring in the grandparents' income, either earned income or Social Security income, what you see is that the children living in those households are much more stable than they would be otherwise.
As part of your research, you've interviewed people about their experiences in multi-generational households. What are some of the most surprising things people have told you, things you might not have expected going into it?
Well, one of the things you find when looking at these households, when research started in this area, it was driven largely by what I discussed about the crack cocaine epidemic and skip generation households. And when researchers went into these households, they were really trying to find out what was wrong. And they were really looking at it from the perspective of what can we do to help these grandparents? And there were a lot of things those grandparents needed. They did need help.
What kinds
but
of
what
things?
Was surprised? Well, some of the challenges that they faced were they couldn't find health insurance for their grandchildren because they didn't officially have custody. Often the parent wouldn't give up custody or it hadn't gone through yet, but the parent wasn't present. So because the grandparent didn't have official custody, they couldn't put the child on their employer-sponsored plan. They couldn't afford a private plan. And often the grandparent wasn't aware that they qualified for Medicaid because their income was above a certain level. And there are exceptions for that for these skip generation households. But
so
grandparents
many logistical
didn't. They weren't
problems.
Aware. That. So a lot of logistical problems. But what surprised researchers is how happy those grandparents often were and how they talked about how much they talked about living with a grandchild and raising a grandchild being meaningful to their lives. It gave meaning to their lives. It gave them a reason to get up every morning. And even though some of them were in extreme poverty, in extremely poor health, they were happy that this had happened to them and they were glad to do it. And I would say that's probably the most surprising thing that's come out of this research is how well these families adjusted. And I think it shows how resilient families are in general.
Are there ways, though, that some of the people involved might actually suffer from the circumstances of life with multiple generations under one roof?
Yeah, some of my research does look into that. So what we find that's particularly hard on grandparents is when they don't have a choice in the matter. So if this is a family strategy that the entire family gets together and says, we're not making enough money to get by, let's all move in together and do this together, whether it's to help out a middle generation that has lost a job, whether it's to help out a grandparent who is in failing health. If the family comes together and makes that decision together, it tends to work out very well. But the circumstances under which it doesn't work out well is when all of a sudden one day, someone comes to the grandparent and says, you take this grandchild today. Yeah. And they don't have room for the child. They don't have money to pay for the child. And they don't have anything set up to do that. So I would say that's probably the situation in which you see the most problems for the grandparents is when they just have no choice in the matter whatsoever.
The possibility that there could be fallout for some family members in a multi-generational household is something that Laura Ziegler's been thinking about. When her mom died, she and her young family, a husband and three children, moved in with her aging father. They lived together for 17 years, and she's often wondered whether that was the right decision. You might recognize Laura's voice because she's a reporter here at KCUR, but this time she tells her own story.
I thought our father had a pretty good opportunity to grow old in his own home. Now, I'm not so sure. At first, I felt like it was the best of all possible worlds.
Of corn that is popping and singers do whopping. So whether it's dangerous, dull, or superb, each sentence you see simply must have a verb.
That's my dad reading to his grandchildren, my kids, when they were toddlers. They nestled on either side of him, wearing their footy PJs and holding their stuffed animals, just like my sisters and I used to do decades ago.
So what is a verb?
Swim, sing.
Swim, right? Sing. What are you doing now, Julia? That's a verb.
Not only did Dad read to us, he made up stories. One was an ongoing saga about the adventures of an elephant, a butterfly, and a box elder bug. Their names were Fifi, Bobo, and Joe.
Bobo was an elephant, and when Bobo was in the jungle, he met Fifi, who was a beautiful orange and black butterfly.
He continued the story with his grandchildren. Spellbound in the same way my sisters and I were, my kids would hang on every word as my father textured the tale with details from his vast knowledge of nature and his own vivid imagination.
She got quite angry and said, "What are you doing?" "Oh," he said, "pardon me, who are you?" And she said, "Well, I'm Fifi and I live here too." So he said, "Well, you can stay on my back and we'll explore through the jungle and see what we find."
My father was a larger-than-life Renaissance man. He studied English and literature in college, but then went on to become a neurologist and chaired the neurology department at the University of Kansas Medical Center for more than two decades. Teaching was in his DNA. But it was my mom, his wife for 40 years, who really allowed him the freedom to accomplish as much as he did. When she died after a year-long battle with cancer, he was traumatized. It shouldn't have come as a surprise when he suggested we move into the family home and live with him. I was ambivalent, but we talked about it and decided to do it anyway. There were a lot of benefits. For example, my dad, passionate about family history, had a wall of archival photographs and clippings outside his bedroom. I loved hearing him teach the kids about their ancestors, providing the comfort and generational continuity. Here's my dad with our son, Ben, then about 9 years old.
Now, you know who that is?
Yep, Jacob Ziegler was your grandpa.
To you? Yeah, it was.
He's my great-great-grandpa.
Your great-great-grandfather.
So these early years, they were mostly really good. We did have our moments. Dad would sometimes yell at the kids when they wouldn't eat their dinner. He couldn't understand why my husband raked the leaves in the fall. And once my husband left for work, he'd retrieve the leaf-packed bags and dump them on the flower beds. But it got harder as Dad got older. He got more and more depressed. I thought maybe the depression was inevitable. After all, he'd lost his wife for 40 years. He was losing friends. But he had us. I recently called Dr. Gary Kennedy to get some insight. He's the director of the Division of Geriatric Psychiatry at Montefiore Hospital in New York.
The best case scenario is what your father experienced.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an educated man who was physically active, socially engaged, lived with his family. That's the ideal.
It turns out depression isn't at all inevitable among the aging. Kennedy says research shows that only about 30% of the aging population actually suffer from clinical depression. So I asked him, what's the difference between those who get depressed and those who don't?
The easiest to define and identify difference is physical illness.
Mm-hmm.
It's that physical disabling issue that probably is number one in late life associated with depression.
This explains a lot. My dad suffered from congestive heart failure. It got worse and worse, and toward his late 80s, he was almost always short of breath. Dad's depression, Kennedy says, could have very well been biochemical.
The brain changes that are associated with cardiovascular disease, whether it's diabetes, hypertension, arrhythmias, or arteriosclerotic disease, all are associated with depression, and they can interfere with a person's capacity to recover.
That was definitely true for my father. On top of being short of breath, he fell a number of times. Pain medicine made him confused, and heart medicine damaged his kidneys. His body became a fragile ecosystem of failing parts. But his mind stayed sharp. Here's some of what that looked like. After one particularly bad fall, he was in rehab for months. During that time, his driver's license expired. He tried to renew it and failed the test. So without a license, he got his caregiver to practice with him on the road. It wasn't until he had an accident that he gave up the keys. Yards of plastic tubing throughout the house allowed my dad to wander around while attached to the oxygen. He loved, for example, to sit in his greenhouse on sunny winter days. But that feeling of isolation consumed him. I began to wonder if we'd made a huge mistake. Would he have gotten remarried? Would he have been happier among peers if he weren't living with us? I called Phil Bolander, a clinical social worker at Wyandotte Center in Kansas City, Kansas, to ask what he sees among his elderly clients. What he said is the more human interaction, the more purpose they have in their lives, the better they do, whether or not they have a physical disability.
You can play cards, you can play checkers, you can be an audio reader person. There's all kinds of things that you can do that require no physical activity whatsoever, but you're having those connections with other people. Human beings need to feel like they're making a difference and they're contributing at any age.
My dad desperately wanted those connections, that sense of purpose, but the betrayal of his body was relentless. He got frustrated. Sometimes he was just grumpy. My daughter had a room next to my dad's. When he'd crank up the heat to the 80s, she'd dial it down so she could study. When he turned up the volume on the TV in the middle of the night so he could hear it, she'd ask him to lower it. I'd hear about it all the next day. One night toward the end, I brought home the movie Departures about Japanese funeral rituals. When it was over, I asked Dad if he liked it. Well, I've been thinking a lot about death, he said. I'd probably have chosen something a little bit lighter. And what are you thinking about? I mean, about death, I asked him. Three things, he said. And then in words that were just so my father, here's what he said. Are my affairs in order? Have I said everything I want to say to the important people in my life? And then, what happens at the moment you die? Is it as if the lights just go out? My father's innate joie de vivre, curiosity, and refusal to give in kept him with us longer than his body wanted to permit. He died on September 13th, 2012. His last words were, "It's okay, I'm ready." I'll never know if we did the best thing for my dad or for my family. It was messy and it was often hard. I worried that I gave my children psychic scars. I demanded they spend time with their grandfather while subjecting them to the sometimes icky stuff of aging. But in the end, I felt like we modeled something good, something many cultures take for granted, respect for the elderly and the value of family. I tell my kids today when they come home, their grandfather is with us still, in the beauty of the spring flowers, the birds that flock to the feeder, and at our dinner table conversations as we discuss everything under the sun.
That was KCUR's Laura Ziegler. Thanks so much for that story, Laura. When Central Standard returns, we want to hear your story. Have you ever considered multi-generational living? Why did you do it or not? What do you wonder about the arrangement and how it works for people in the long run? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about multi-generational living in Kansas City. Are you part of that trend toward families stacking two, three, even four generations on top of each other in one home? Call 816-235-2888 to tell us why and how it's going. Or if you've considered it and you have questions, feel free to ask those too. 816-235-2888. I'm here with Lindsay Baker. She's joining us from UMKC's Consortium on Aging and Community, and she's done research on multi-generational living. Hi again, Lindsay.
Hi, how are you?
We just heard a story by KCUR's Laura Ziegler about moving with her husband and kids into her dad's house after her mom passed away. Laura wondered if that might not have hindered her dad in some way or prevented him from moving on to a new stage of life with peers. You're a psychologist. Is there a valid concern there that in some ways we might prevent our relatives from growing and making it on their own in that American independent spirit by stepping in and trying to spare them the difficult adjustments that might entail?
Well, I would tend to agree with the researchers in that story in that, you know, it kind of depends on the individual, but, you know, I think that living in a multi-generational household, if it's the choice of the people in that household, has a lot of benefits for the social connectedness of that person.
And we had such beautiful conversations that Laura had the opportunity to have with her dad that I can't imagine if they had lived separately.
Yeah. You know, it's possible that had he lived independently, he may have met someone and married. It's also possible that he may have been isolated, not met anyone, and instead of being connected into this family, he would have just been alone. So I'm not sure that you can really say necessarily that you know, living in a multi-generational household is going to prevent you from making connections with your peers or with other people, because the more connections you have with people, it's kind of an exponential benefit. You know, the more connections you have with your family, the more chance you have to get out and meet other new people. So living alone is not necessarily going to be inherently better than living with your family members.
I want to turn to Emily Bordner on this. She's got a different story. She's a young woman whose career causes her to split her time between Kansas City and Los Angeles. So when she's here about half of the time, why don't I let her explain it? Emily, what's your setup?
So last year I lived bicoastally in LA and in Independence with my mother. It didn't really make much sense to me to pay for rent here and in LA simultaneously. So I actually also have a business. So I have a studio in her basement where half the space is my business and then half the space is like my living quarters. So it works really well for us. I also spend more time with her that way, which I think we both appreciate. So yeah, it works really well for us.
How old are you?
I'm 28.
So, I mean, we heard about a stigma earlier, a stigma around multi-generational living, and it probably applies most to your age group because some people, I mean, in general, I think people understand that the elderly and little kids might need someone living with them. But sometimes if you're like young and aspiring as a professional and you don't have your own place, that can be seen as a measure of how you're doing like success wise. Have you felt that?
Yeah, it's really fun to talk about that on dates. No, but outside of that, I think I feel pretty comfortable with it as of right now. Like I poke fun of myself most of the time for it. And I do that mostly, I think, because I feel so confident with where I am, like, professionally. And so I think it's fine for me right now. And plus, if I'm here for a longer stints of time, like for 6 months or longer, I'll usually, like, find a place in town to live just so I'm not commuting all the time.
Because you were saying your mom, she lives where again?
Independence. So it's not that far. Like, it's, like, maybe 15, 20 minutes. But my whole life is in, like, the Crossroads or Midtown. So it works. Yeah, it's pretty funny when I talk about it with people. But I don't mind it. I feel pretty comfortable with it.
You were saying that you and your mom mostly like spending time together. I mean, what has it been like? Are there things you've gotten out of the situation that you didn't expect?
Yeah, you know, we did our taxes together last week, which was awesome. And
you are on the ball.
Yeah, I'm trying. But yeah, no, I think it's, you know, it's nice to like catch that daily, like, hey, how was it? You know, how's your day going? Was there anything specifically that, you know, you want to talk about? Or, hey, you got some mail? Or I don't know. It's just like, you know, I feel like in any living situation I've lived with anybody outside of my mother, you just have a more intimate relationship with that person by default for that extended period of time. So I feel like we've definitely gotten closer living together. So yeah, I think it's been good. We went out to brunch last week for her birthday with family and, you know, did taxes and stuff. So it's, you know, it's been nice.
Would you consider doing it or recommend it to someone else, even if circumstances didn't kind of push you toward it?
Yeah, I mean, I have definitely for people that I've talked to, especially if like they are financially strained, and even otherwise, I think it's nice. I mentioned talking to Matt that I also worked at Kaleidoscope for a while, and I worked with some women, and they always encouraged me to spend more time with my mother while she was like able-bodied and not not sickly, like not later in life when I'm 50 and she's, you know, kind of falling apart, but, you know, taking advantage of getting to know her and doing things with her while she's able-bodied and young.
Lindsay, on the aging spectrum, we've talked so much about living with older generations as they do enter that stage where they need someone's care, bringing them into closer interaction with their grandkids, even maybe great-grandkids. But what do you know about this trend when it comes to parents and their adult children? We've kind of not talked about those adult children yet.
In terms of how it impacts the adult yeah. children? You know, we don't know as much about that as we probably should. Part of that, you know, when we look at research into multi-generational households, part of the reason for that is that those households are much less common than you would think. So the vast majority of multi-generational households, the grandparent is the head of the household. They're not, you know, moving in with adult children. And so you have a really small sample size to look at it, which makes it difficult to find out what's happening in those households. So we don't know a ton about what's going on there. I would say that probably the biggest challenge that you're going to see in those households is the conflict of kind of a role reversal. If you have a parent who's being taken care of in those households and needs a lot of personal care and needs a lot of help from their child, that can be a strain on the relationship because you've got an adult child who's used to acting as the child. They're not used to having to take care of their parent. They're used to it being the other way around. And there can be problems that arise because of that. There can be resentments. It's difficult for a parent to step into that role of being taken care of by their child. So I would say that's probably the thing that we know the most about is how difficult those roles can be on those children and how much burden it could create for those caregivers and conflict with their jobs, with their children, within the household.
And again, that's in situations where the parent needs care, which is obviously not Emily's circumstance and probably not the circumstance for a lot of 20-somethings moving back home.
Exactly.
We're also joined by Lois Ritchie. Lois, what's your story?
Well, we live in a 4-generation household. I have my son and daughter-in-law and 3 young grandchildren and a teenage grandson. I'd say that we have a pretty good, solid relationship. I feel that, yes, I am the dominant. I won't lie about that.
You're in charge.
Yes.
Was it your home that everyone else kind of moved into or some other arrangement?
No. What happened is my son, who is the father of my teenage grandson, needed a place for him and his sister to be. Because the home was splitting up and the children were going to wind up in the system, as they would call that. And he came to me and said, Mom, I'm in trouble. I need your help. We talked about it and I discussed it with social worker. And we decided that we would join forces and raise these 2 children. So the oldest one is away from home now and I still have Jacob, who's a junior in high school. And Bill met someone and started having children with Francis, who is 20 years younger than him. So there's another there's that generation. So they have 3 little girls, 4, 6, and 8.
This is, I mean, did you imagine that at this stage in your life you would be still raising small children, and if not, like how has that adjustment to that reality been for you?
Well, no, I had other plans. I was close to retirement. I thought at that stage and was going to do some traveling, enjoy myself, and along comes this, and here we are. You know, but it hasn't really been that difficult. I wasn't planning on three young grandchildren, of course, but they've kept me young for sure.
You do feel that they've kept you youthful.
I do. I spend time with them. We go places together. We enjoy each other. I mean, and of course there's little sibling rivalry once in a while, but, you know, overall I'd say it's a pretty good combination. We all work together to make it happen right.
Has your relationship with your son and his wife been strong in spite of the close quarters, or maybe even enhanced by the close quarters?
Well, I'd say it's gotten stronger. I feel as the girls get older and we have a little more time together, I think it's getting stronger. I mean, we have a pretty good understanding about what goes on in the home between each other.
Can you relate to what you've heard so far this morning in the conversation, or are there things that have been said that you would want to either take exception to or just complicate a little bit with your own experience?
Well, I wouldn't take exception to it exactly, but I just feel that since I'm in good health, and I am in good health, that me being a part of that family has been a good experience for me. I mean, it really has. It's made me realize that we can all be together and enjoy each other. And that's what's important.
Emily Bordner, Lois Ritchie, thanks for sharing your stories this morning. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll hear from the Argentine neighborhood's city commissioner about how families there make existing housing work for multiple generations, a fairly common arrangement in that neighborhood. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about multi-generational living in Kansas City. Now, let's dig into the trends here specifically. Lindsay Baker, gerontologist, I'm looking at a pie chart provided to us by the Mid-America Regional Council showing where Kansas Cityans 65 years and older live in our community. According to their data, 65% live with family, 28% live alone, 4% live in a nursing home, and 3% live with someone else who isn't a relative. Now, we all know that 65 is the new 45, which is probably why such a small sliver of this demographic is in nursing homes. But mm-hmm. I'm surprised to see 65% living with family. Are you?
I haven't seen those data specifically. My guess is, and I can't remember exactly how you read that down, my guess is that that number includes spouses. So most of those households, 65%, would be people living with their spouse alone and not with any children. So I'm not sure exactly what the breakdown is there. So I think that those households are not, you know, they're not nearly that common. I don't have the numbers exactly off the top of my head. I do know that you know, when you look at grandchildren specifically, about 10% of grandchildren do live with a grandparent. When you look at all households in the United States, about 3% are what you'd consider multi-generational, but that doesn't necessarily include parents who are living with their young children, not young children, but working age children. So children in the 20 to 30 range. So it's not a common situation, but it's becoming increasingly common.
Let's hear from Anne Murguia. She's the city commissioner for the Argentine neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas. Anne, I know this subject is personal for you, and we'll get to your own experience in a minute. But for now, how does multi-generational living come into your role representing the Argentine community professionally?
So, Gina, thanks for having me on your show. I'd just like to tell you a little bit about the Argentine neighborhood. It's predominantly Hispanic. And as a result, what I've seen is that traditional Hispanic living, it is not uncommon to see multiple generations living in the same household. I don't know that it's created any sort of issues or any sort of problems other than just an observation that you have many generations living together in the same house.
What? Have you gone into a lot of households and seen kind of how people either make this arrangement work or maybe struggle with it?
I haven't seen as much of a struggle with it as I've seen the benefits of it. As an Anglo person, I can relate much to what some of your other speakers have said about I was encouraged to leave the home after 18, to go to college, to get a job, to work towards my independence and self-sufficiency, where those values are very important in the Hispanic community, but what is most important is family and remaining connected to your family throughout your entire life. And as long as you're not married, living at home with your nuclear family is very much accepted, and I may be going a little far, but not much, to say expected.
People tend to think of this as such a personal, like, individual issue or question, and not something that has maybe either political ramifications or a civic aspect to it. Is there something that makes it a civic matter for you?
No, not really. I would tell you, I think when you get complaints about several adults living in a house, it's typically this kind of scenario. It's a scenario where, at least in Kansas City, Kansas, you, for example, would have several unrelated adult males living in a single-family home in a neighborhood. There are concerns with that. That technically does not meet our city code, but it's a very hard thing to enforce, because to figure that out, you'd almost have to knock on the door and speak to those people, and they'd have to provide proof that they are not related, since that's the only that our code only addresses those situations where the adults are not related. So it can cause some problems like that, and it can cause some problems within the neighborhood's interaction with one another, people that live there. But other than that, I have not seen any other issues.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I say issue, I don't necessarily mean problem. I just mean, like, are there design considerations? Like, you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. So, yes, there are design considerations. So one of the things that we've struggled with is having the appropriate housing stock to deal with multi-generational living. So since I represent a predominantly Hispanic community, and much of that community is either engaged in or will engage in multi-generational housing, there is a housing stock that's more appropriate, in my opinion, and the opinion of the people I represent, in dealing with that. For example, having a ranch-style home is much better than a two-story, because it allows for multiple adults that are older to be on the same level. And that's nice in case they run across some health issues that make climbing stairs difficult for them. The challenges we run into is that ranch-style housing is very, very expensive compared to two-story housing. For example, it's much cheaper to build a two-story home that's 1,600 square feet than it is to build a 1,600-square-foot ranch-style home, since most of the cost in building a residential home is in the foundation work. Plus, then you add to just the way urban neighborhoods are designed and laid out, the lots in which the housing stock are built on are very small and definitely not conducive to the spread out style of a ranch style home.
You know, and I would think a ranch style home, for all of the benefits it would provide to maybe the older members of that household, when you have many generations living together, those separate floors to kind of give people a little space, I would think would come in handy in their own way, though. You haven't found that that's a need?
Yeah, I think we are saying the same thing. I think absolutely. If you're talking about affordability, though, the footprint of a two-story house is smaller and will only accommodate so much space. So getting a master bedroom or multiple bedrooms to accommodate the older people in the house, and then having a second story to accommodate, you know, allowing for separate quarters and allowing for living space for younger people, it's a great idea, but it still comes to the size of the house. I'm not sure I'm explaining it very well. So, yes, it would be great to have a 1,600-square-foot main level and a 1,600-square-foot second level, but the cost of that, you're looking at a 3,200-square-foot house. That's a large home by anyone's standards.
Yeah, and then you've got to heat it and...
and cool it, and the cost. So I think it's the size of the house you have to take into consideration. But, yes, if you could build a very large, spread-out two-story, obviously that would be better than ranch or a smaller two-story.
So are you working to get more ranch housing stock in your neighborhood, or is that something that's sort of beyond the scope of what you can do within your role?
You know, we have not been lucky enough to figure that out. As I said, the lots in the urban core are very small and are not conducive to spread out ranch-style housing. It's been very difficult to build that kind of housing. One thing we have done to modify the housing stock that we are building in the Argentine neighborhood is to at least get the master bedroom and a master bathroom on the main level so that can be occupied by the person that needs to be all on the same level, usually a grandparent, and putting the other bedrooms upstairs. That's as good as we have been able to meet those needs, but we're always looking for different ideas and different options.
What's your own experience with multi-generational living?
Well, just my personal experience is that, as I said, I'm Anglo, and I married a Hispanic male. And when we were married, he was almost 40 years old, and he lived with his mother at the time. And it was not an economic situation. He had a very good job. It was a living arrangement by choice.
And so did you move into that household too?
No. And actually, I think I could have, and it would have been fine. When we got married, we moved into our own house. But what was interesting is that from my perspective, is as I've said before, in the Hispanic culture, it just seems to be something that you do. If you're not married, you live with your parents and your nuclear family. And then when you get married, you can move out and move into your own house. Now, sometimes you have situations, not just in the Hispanic culture, but a variety of different racial and ethnic groups, that economics force you to live with parents. And as people have talked about today, that was not our situation. We both had good jobs and were able to live in our own home. But I will tell you, the family that I married into, we all live in the same neighborhood, and we all have homes within a mile or less than, I say a mile, but it's even less than that, within a block of each other. And there are four of those homes. And even within those four homes, in one of them, there is multi-generational living. So I think what has to do more with that is that the economics, that we are in a financial situation to own our own homes.
Lindsay Baker, you know, you are with us from UMKC's Consortium on Aging and Community. What do you think about this idea that we've touched on, that there's a role for design and policy in making multi-generational living both feasible and comfortable, even maybe normalizing it?
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple things I would say about that. First of all, it's incredibly challenging. You've already talked about a lot of the design issues that happen, and I would throw one more caveat on top of that, is that most of these households are not permanent. So most of these households are formed for a year or less, and then people move on. And so when you talk about making design changes to houses or building separate houses or building housing units for these families, what happens is people then end up leaving, and that housing style no longer fits their needs. So it's a real challenge to be able to do that. But say, you know, that being said, I think there is a lot of benefit to living in these types of households, and there is a been a really an increasing importance of multi-generational bonds as a whole in our society. And I see a lot of optimism in that and combating kind of the age segregation that we see in today's society.
Our time is up for this morning's discussion, but I want to thank all of our guests, Lindsay Baker from UMKC's Department of Psychology and the Consortium on Aging and Community. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Anne Merguia, City Commissioner for Argentine and KCK. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
Earlier in the show, we heard personal stories from Emily Bordner, Lois Ritchie, and KCUR's own Laura Ziegler. To listen back to anything you've heard, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have that audio ready for your enjoyment and sharing later today. You can also sign up for our podcast while you're there. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, a dystopian future set in Kansas City. Don't miss that. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.